My name is Mike, and I am an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday night Blue Chip Speaker Meeting at the NABA Club. Where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story.
Hey everybody, I'm Tim. I'm an alcoholic. And we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us will be persuaded to say, yes, I'm one of them too. I must have this thing. Tonight's speaker is Martin. I know Martin from the Winter Circle meeting. Winter Circle meets at First Methodist Church of Chamblee on Thursday night, Big Book Study on Thursday night. Saturday night, when I usually go, is a speaker meeting, sometimes two 20-minute speakers, sometimes one. It is a fantastic meeting with a lot of young people. Some of them are here tonight. Thanks for coming, guys. The meeting's at 8, but these guys get there at 5:30 or 6 o'clock. They play basketball. They've all... A lot of musicians, they play. It's really a fun place to go to an AA meeting, and my wife loves it. You know, that's her favorite meeting. We love to go on a Saturday night, and Martin's one of the guys there that was always looking for newcomers, doing the deal, and it's encouraging to see a bright young guy like that that really grabs this thing and runs with it, and they're not just make it fun, remind you how much fun it can be to be sober. Martin, you're at home here. Please help me welcome Martin.
My name is Martin. I'm an alcoholic.
Yes.
Girls. Okay. So I would like to read something to start from the big book, and it's from page 172, and it's like Rob's story. And then he says, "My whole life seemed to be centered around doing what I wanted to do without regard for the rights, wishes, or privileges of anyone else." And that's my story. I could literally sit down from here, but that wouldn't be very exciting. My name is Martin. I'm definitely an alcoholic, and I originally thought that meant that I drank too much alcohol, which is absolutely the truth in my life. I got here to AA and learned from a lot of knowledgeable individuals who had not only experienced the depths of alcoholism, but recovery from it, and they taught me that there's this thing called the spiritual malady that's ultimately what I dealt with, right? And so in having a spiritual malady and being an extremely selfish and self-centered individual, not only did I do a lot of alcohol, I did a lot of drugs. I did a lot of self-centered behaviors manifesting in hurting others, whether it be maybe physically or just violent or sexually. All the things that we do, I've done them all. So, jumping into the story, let's see, I'm from North Georgia. I remember my first time drinking. It's one of those things that just remind me that I'm an alcoholic. So, we call them screwdrivers. I didn't know that at the time, orange juice and vodka. And, I was like, I was 12 years old, and so when we're drinking this vodka, and we're just chasing it with orange juice, and just got, you know, for a 12-year-old, and you're chugging vodka, I got extremely drunk, and we ran out of orange juice not long into it, because we didn't like the way the vodka tasted, and we were in his parents' basement, it was me and another friend, and so, you know, obviously, you know, 12 years old, I already got to the point where I didn't want to stop drinking, so what, you know, being out of orange juice, so I just started chasing the vodka with the mouthwash, which also has a little extra alcohol in there for me as well. And so, and I can remember that was on like a Thursday night and being like at a church service that following Sunday, like still throwing up. Obviously, like, when you're 12 years old and your mother is not a drug addict or alcoholic, she just thought it was a stomach bug or some sort. So, just like right from the rip, you know, like people talk about, you know, using and feeling wholesome or whatever. Like, I got that. I was addicted from the get-go, from my first use, it seemed. That was my first drink. I remember the first time using a substance. I was 12. It was just a little before this. I never thought that I was doing something bad, honestly. I was, you know, you hang out and you want to be cool growing up. That's a normal thing. You want to be accepted by others. And it just happened to be the group that I wanted to be accepted by were some of these older guys who were doing drugs and alcohol. And so, and this, my same friend's older brother, and he said, "Hey, do you want to take these?" And it didn't even register to me, "Hey, do you want to do drugs and be a bad boy?" I heard, you know, "Do you want to be cool?" Yeah, I wanted to be cool. I'm a 12-year-old boy. That's all I wanted to be in that moment in my life. And so, and I, you know, I had never known what I wanted to do with my life. 12 years old, most people want to be an astronaut or a doctor or a cowboy or something like that, something cool, or a professional athlete. I didn't have much direction at that point. And I took those pills, and I'm telling you, 37 minutes later, I knew in my heart I wanted to be a pharmacist. And we laugh. I literally followed that for a couple of years, and I continued to look into like what college I would get online. I'd be like, well, you know, where's it good to go and be a pharmacist and blah blah blah. And the funny thing about that is you actually have to study and do good work at school and stuff. And I wasn't doing that at all. That was not a byproduct of my drug use. And so, so I just got into dealing drugs. Next best thing, right? And so, You know, it didn't seem abnormal at the time. It's such a retrospective thing. You know, I'm in middle school, and I'm stealing, you know, these hard liquors, and I'm sure I went through this, and, like, I put just a little bit of every kind of liquor, and I got some Bailey's, like, cream stuff in there with, like, some, you know, got some moonshine, and then I got a shot of, you know, a little bit of some champagne or something, and, like, man, I would nurse that bottle, middle school. And I did so good in middle school, they let me have a second year of eighth grade. And so, so I did that, and I went to a new middle school. I got in trouble at the one I'd been in, and more trouble at another one. And so in middle school, I first got introduced to the idea of recovery in a way. I got some trouble with some substances and some alcohol at school. And so it led to a bunch of trouble at home, and ultimately led to a first suicide attempt. And my mom tells this really pitiful story of me coming to in the hospital, right? And I think they pumped my stomach and some stuff. She talks about I'm crying, right? And she says, all I can say is I just want to feel better, right? And that was really the truth. Like, I really did not want to be bad. I genuinely wanted to feel better. And the book talks about chasing that insanity to the gates of alcohol, or the chasing alcohol to the gates of insanity or death. And I literally have lived a couple years of my life like hanging on those gates, like wanting to be on the other side, it seems like. And so a very evident higher power has continually worked to not let me end up on that other side. And so I get introduced to recovery. And so I'm this little middle schooler, and they take me into these classes, and what do? They teach you about every substance and type of alcohol in the world, and your mind is just blown. And like, when you're at that age, it was just absolutely baffling. And so I left. I'm just so excited to get into all the other things that I had been missing out on. And so, you know, I didn't know these things that, like, oh, I've been having all those terrible headaches because wine has sugar in that. And, like, I learned that in there. And it was like, oh, great. And so went on to high school. And so I got really into playing basketball. You know, like, the obsessive nature. You know, I don't know. I feel like a lot of us probably struggle with that. I know I sure did. And so I would literally, I would wake up sometimes, and I would practice like 5 a.m. I would do drugs through the evening in my apartment, my house, and with my brother, who I'm so glad is here tonight. We did a lot of drugs together. Now we're in AA together. That's fun. And I would still manage to get the insanity or the neuroticism because I got, you know, a desire to be enough so bad to make others notice me that I could be enough. And so I was going to be the best at anything I did. When I was little, I was going to be the best at yo-yoing. I was going to be the best at pogs or building, you know, little boats or whatever it was. I wanted to be noticed. I wanted to be enough. And so that manifested in basketball. And so I'd wake up and I'd practice. Then I'd go to school and practice. And then I would drink throughout the school day or do drugs throughout the school day, whatever I could get my hands on. I got in trouble throughout my freshman year of high school. Got suspended a couple games. Our county was like one of the first counties in Georgia to start the random drug screening thing, where like they'll just come in on a random day and just test all the athletes. And you have like a couple hundred athletes in a big high school. And isn't it funny that I somehow got chosen like that first time? And they called my sweet little mother once again, who's just like an amazing woman. And they're like, you know, hey, your son's failed for this. And my mom called me, and, you know, she's like, Martin, you have failed for drugs, you know. And I jumped on there, and I was like, oh, mom, you know, I didn't know that there was marijuana in that cigarette. And I immediately ripped into my lies. And, you know, she replied back with that, filled with much more intense substances. I had some cocaine and some other pills in there. So busted myself for marijuana was just another side note there. So the consequences started to roll in. And still at that age, I had lived in such an intense amount of that neuroticism that I was talking about, wanting to be okay, and that the alcohol relieved that for me, that there was no way in my mind I thought that I could give that up. It just didn't seem plausible. And so really just like trying to think like, well, how can I, right, we talk about an environment, you know, how can I change my environment, how can I change my brand, how can I change, you know, I will change everything around me to make sure I can still continue to drink and ultimately achieve the result that alcohol produces in my life. And so I'll lessen my ambitions of the college I want to try to go to. I'll lessen, you know, how I want to be seen by my friends and family or the people I hang out with or, you know, girlfriend's expectations, whatever it be, you know. I changed all those things so I continued to drink and do drugs ultimately the way I wanted to do. So I think my sophomore year, maybe, I woke up in the middle of the night. I got in Colton with like a couple hundred pills. And so, you know, when you're a sophomore in high school and you can barely drive, you're not supposed to have a bunch of illegal drugs. And so I woke up in the middle of the night, and my brother's there. Our parents are divorced. They've been divorced their whole life. And everybody, he's dressed up. Everybody had like something fairly nice on. My mom had something nice on. My dad had like a collared shirt on. And my stepdad was there. And so it seems like a dream. And then there's these two very large men, these bald-headed large men who are quite muscular, all in my bedroom. And it's 3 a.m. And so it's like, you know, is this a dream? Is it way too real to be a dream? And they're like, all right, Martin, we're sending you away to school for a while. And that was exciting to me. I was like, yes, going to, you know, somewhere fun. And we get in the car, and it's really weird. I'm sure someone's done it. One of the dudes sits in the back, and he keeps his hand on you the whole time. It's like a six-hour car ride with this large man with just like a hand on me at all times. And he tries to carry on and talk, though, like we're good and we're friends the whole time. And they drove me to one of those survival urban wilderness schools where you hike around in the woods for a few months, and that'll sober you up, and you won't drink alcohol anymore, supposedly, is the idea behind that. And so 3 months later, I get out of this program, and I come back, and obviously I go see the girlfriend, right, because that's of monumental importance. And so, and I'm, you know, they talk about if you hook me up to a lab test or test, I would have said that I didn't want to do it again. And I was there. Like, I was in high school, right, you know, drinking too much, and then I'd go get, and there was a family restroom at our high school, and I would just lay there on the floor and just vomit and cry. And I would, like, talk to God, or who I perceived to be God at the moment, and, you know, if you could sober me up, or if you could help me change my life, you know, like, I wanted to do that. And so when I went to this place and I got back, I really wanted to, like, not ever do drugs again. I truly meant that in my heart. We had never implemented a plan, though, what would happen if I ran into alcohol or drugs again. And so that very night, when I went to see the girlfriend, the younger brother was like, hey, man, you know, I thought about you the other week when these chocolates came through town. And I thought, what a kind gesture. I'm clearly going to eat this. For those who don't know in the audience, those are hallucinogenic mushrooms covered in chocolate. And so I ate those. And so, you know, it was one of those nights where it was one of the worst nights of my life. There was absolutely no fun to it, where you're just hugging the porcelain God, you know, and just praying, you know, God, if you sober me up, I'll never do this again. And so I sobered up, and of course I went and did that again. And so, you know, this just gets worse and worse. And I eventually get to go to college. And I didn't do anything to get into a college. I met a man who, him and his brother, had graduated, and they were financial supporters of the college. And so I got to go to Belmont University in Nashville to do music business, to study music business. And so you won't believe it. They had alcohol and drugs in Nashville, y'all. And so, you know, I kept off the hard stuff. I kept it to just, like, right, drinking beers, right, and to smoking marijuana, and to just, you know, shooting the hard liquor and stuff. And I didn't see a problem with that. Like, that's not weird if you wake up and shotgun some beers and a couple shots of liquor and, you know, maybe snort a little Adderall because you are a student now, right? And so, like, it was, like, literally, like, I thought that I was doing great. And I'd go about my day and be like, man, you're killing it at life. And meanwhile, other people don't, you know, they don't put vodka in a water bottle and go to class. I mean, we all do. Probably everybody see people in here shaking their heads. That makes sense to us. And so I continued to get in trouble, right? I mean, and that's essentially it. While in Nashville, I did 3 full years of college, 2 summer semesters. I took over 100 credits. I got banned from the University of Vanderbilt. I got banned from the Ryman Auditorium. I got banned from Belmont University. So at this point, I'm banned from a large part of Nashville. And so so I decided to come back home. And so and on that drive home, you know, I got banned from those schools because it's frowned upon to be found in family bathrooms with syringes in your arms passed out by visitors. That's looked down upon. And so I fell asleep while driving. I shot up on the way home. I fell asleep while driving. And I crashed in between. I mean, if you've ever been to Nashville, there's these mountain roads. There's nothing there. And I crashed where they happened to be doing construction work, and they put up those things on the very edge of the highway, on the white lines, those little walls. You know, it's just one of those things you look back on, and it's just like, whoa. You know, like, in the moment, I didn't even think twice about it. I was just upset that I crashed, and, you know, they're not my drugs. Like, we're going to put these on the cockpit here. But, like, I look back on it, and I just remember, like, whoa. You know, like, how lucky have I been? How lucky have I been all those times? And So yeah, I came and speaking of my scholastic experience, I wasn't doing good while I was there. When I went back to school in sobriety here in the past few years, after taking 100-something credits, I transferred into GPC with 8. So, I don't even know how that... It doesn't even seem possible. So, and there were some that I did actually pass that GPC just didn't care how much you knew about the record business. That didn't seem applicable to a psychology degree, so understandable. So, but I know a lot about RCA. And, things got worse. Things always got worse. I would make these half-hearted attempts to do some sober time. And throughout this time, in Nashville, I would get into a little recovery here and there, and I would genuinely try. I really would try, these attempts that I thought were trying. And I came back, and I tried to, just be a man and get a job, right, just to grow up. And I always thought that, when I was 18 and I was doing the things I was doing, or even earlier in middle school, I just thought one day I'll wake up and I won't drink like this. Right, I'll be a man, and I had these thoughts that I would have this family, and I would have these great kids. I don't care what color you want to paint your fence. Mine wasn't going to be white though, but I would have that dog and that cat and all those good things. And and I would sit on the bar stool, right, and I would just imagine being plucked from that place into this one. I could always imagine here, but I never was willing to put in the work to get there. And ultimately, because I was so scared that I would fail and never make it. Right, and so I hid in the bottle. I hid in the substances because I was too fearful to ever. I couldn't even muster the courage to go for the things I wanted to in life. And so I came back home, and I'm going to try to be this man. And I'm working, and work is not going well. I was stacking dead chicken for a point, and stacking dead chicken doesn't go good when you're a drug addict and alcoholic. And then I became a Mason. And I gotten really big into the idea that if I could just not do drugs and not do too much hard liquor, that was genuinely sobriety. I believe that somehow. I genuinely believe that was sobriety. And so I would go to NA. And so I would be, I haven't done any heroin for this long. I am clearly sober. And I would pick up chips and I would tell you how to do the deal. And I stayed away from AA because I was not drinking. And so it was bad, y'all. I remember I got kicked out of the Hall County Hawk Club one time because I passed out of a chair. I was literally I went in, right, and I'm all hopped up and drunk. And so front row seems like a good place when you're on your A game. And but 30 minutes into the meeting, and it's really all starting to take it. And I started to do that dance that we do when we're... this one, and I went too far forward, and I just fell out of the chair, and the discussion person just took me outside and asked me not to come back that day, at least. And so, let's see. At that point, I woke up every day, and a lot of people talk about, they get to recovery, and they're scared of dying, and I get that. There was a lot of fear of death on some level. I had gotten to a point where I was scared of living, and that really was the case. I woke up every day, and I would cry. That's how I would start my day. Here I am supposed to be this man. I'm raised in the Southeast United States. I'm a man, and I like football, and I like beer, and I am tough. Rah. And, I carry these large these big knives in my car and stuff, and I wake up and I cry every day. I wake up and I cry every day because I was terrified because I knew what I was going to do to feel the way I wanted to feel, right? I didn't want to do what I was going to have to do to drink or to do drugs again that one more day. And I knew that I didn't have the ability not to do it. And it was such a miserable thing for me. And I remember waking up, and I had been at my father's house that night, and I was sitting in the bathroom and I was crying. And so this was, we have morning routines these days. That was my morning routine back then. And so I'm sitting in the bathroom, and I'm just crying, just sitting on the floor of the bathroom crying. And I had the weirdest thought, and I was like, today I'm going to get arrested doing what I do. And I actually got arrested that day. It wasn't cool. I remember sitting in the jail and being like, wow, I really, really messed that one up. So, and I got in trouble for another burglary charge. And, that's what I did every day. I woke up and I went and broke into people's houses. And, it was a good living. This is how I made it to Atlanta from North Georgia, right? And they sent me to Ridgeview, right? And so I'm always willing to play ball with the law. I got in trouble in Nashville. I got in trouble with some juvie in Hall County. I was always willing to do whatever it took to reduce the sentence. But I never wanted, you know, like I never was truly willing to want something different for my life to the extent that we're going to do the kind of work we do in AA. And so I went to Ridgeview, and we started, you know, Atlanta AA was a lot better than Hall County AA and Nashville AA that I'd been to. There were pretty girls, lots more coffee, and you didn't have to fight over it. And there were, like, young people, period, was exciting. In Hall County, there were a lot of, you know, just, and they're too old, and you're not old enough, and they always spilt more than you drank, and so it was an intimidating place. So I went to Ridgeview. I left Ridgeview. They encouraged me to go to Hope Homes, and I went to Hope Homes, and I got kicked out of one of the Hope Homes. I wasn't really doing the deal. I went to like 8-9 meetings a day. I was just a meeting, you know, like I would make some meetings, and essentially because I really wanted to socialize. And but I wasn't really doing the step work, right? Which was where I now would tell you that most of all my changes come from. I'll break all the rules. I'll have girls over. I'd smoke cigs in the apartment. I would do these gas station drugs as well as this thing I went through. I would go to like the vitamin shop, and he'd be like, take one for relaxation at night. So I'd wake up and I'd take like 32 of them, and no joke. And or I'd go to the gas station, you know, it'd be like Zan X, and they actually spell it Zanx, and I'd be like, oh, that's clearly necessary for my work day. And so then I got into this weird thing because I'm a trash can, man. I don't care what you got. Anytime, anywhere, I want to feel different than how I felt inside for a large amount of time. So I got into, I don't know what to call them, besides boner pills. They give you a rush, right? They make you feel like you're on uppers. And so I would go to a gas station. I would eat 5 or 6 of these boner pills and just, like, go to a work day. And, you talk about, like, a weird and lost boy. I remember my mother and I were going to go to Nashville I was in trouble with the law, and we had to go face some court struggles. And it's funny, but this is how miserable I was, that I'm going on a 5-hour car ride with my mother, and we get to the gas station, and I don't have an ID. So what did I buy? I bought 5 boner pills, and I took those bad boys for a 5-hour car ride with my mother. And I'm talking about a weird car ride. And it is funny, and we laugh now, but the how pitiful I felt in my heart to have to make that decision at the time was like, I was sad, y'all. I was sad. And so, anyway, so weird stuff like that. Meanwhile, I'm thinking I'm sober. Before I'd gotten into some of those drugs, I had acquired about a year of clean time, or separation from substances. And I was sponsoring people, and I was going to meetings, and I was willing to make some amends to, like, some family members and to some friends and stuff. But I wasn't really doing the deal. I got kicked out of one Hope Homes for choking out my best buddy that's frowned upon. And And then I went to another Hope Homes, and I got kicked out of that one. And I lived on my own for a while. I actually was making some good money. To me, I was rich. You know, I lived in an apartment that I thought was absolutely awesome. I was buying guitars and amps that were and pedals that I didn't even know how to use, and I was buying them up. And I was driving a cool truck, and, you know, I was paying my own rent and paying some bills. And so I just really thought, right, all these things that I've been living my life thinking, if I can set all these things up, I'll feel okay. And I had all these things, and I wasn't drinking, and I didn't feel okay. And the apartment that I used to love coming to on the Chattahoochee River and thinking it's awesome, I get pissed off when just the bills come in, or I got to clean it up, right? And the job that asked me to come in on the occasional Saturday or like the extra day of the week or whatever, like I get, I slander them, and I get angry, and I get ungrateful for it. And the girl who used to think, oh, this is going to be a possible bride, now she's a ball-busting ball and chain. You know what I'm saying? And so it's just like, what changed? You know, none of those things did. The girl never did anything different, right? And the apartment situation never changed, or the work situation never changed. That ism that, right, like, exists within me, I don't know what you want to call it, that just that darkness, like, it was still so alive because I hadn't really done this work to change it. And I could not be present. I constantly lived in the fear of my past, what I had done, and what was going to happen. I was never able to live in the here and the now. I should never take a conscious breath. And so I essentially went back to the only thing that had ever produced a present moment in my life, and that was alcohol. Right? Because when I drink, I wasn't fearful of what I had just done to get that drink. And when I drink, I'm not fearful of what's going to happen when I'm done drinking. Like, I'm just there being drunk. And so I went back to that. right? And having all those things within that first week, I was in the hospital for an overdose, and not long after I moved on some sober guys. They had kicked me out, and so I'm living out of my truck, and I've gotten on this spin of shooting crack cocaine, which was not a wise choice if anybody's thinking about doing it. And it got really bad, you know, and there's no need to go into some of the craziness of it. You know, the externals are all, you know, there's so many people in here tonight who, you know, I don't know, there's some people in here who've done some things that I've never done, you know, and there's some, it's all externals. You know, like I used to go to these first step meetings, and people used to talk about how many people they've pissed on and pissed off, and just like all, you know, how many times they've been arrested and the crazy stuff they've done. And then some other people over here have never done that stuff, and so they're wondering where were they at, you know, where did they fit in? And I just realized, like, those are all externals. That bit of surrender that I'd always been trying to, like, process and figure out, you know, like, what did that mean, surrender? Well, like an internal thing. It was just like a light that finally came on one day, and just realized, like, my butt was whooped by drugs and alcohol. And I can remember when it happened. I had a second suicide attempt, parasuicide is what it's called. And I had pawned every little bit of thing I had left, and I had bought what's called an A-ball. I'm sure some of y'all in the crowd know what that is. And I called this little spiritual teacher that I absolutely loved, and that I had fallen in love with him while I was sober. I never did anything that he said, but gosh, I could just like see that like something was real in his life. And I told him what was going to happen and what I was going to do. And so when I did that, I loaded up all these drugs and this, I shot it up, and I went into like this like seizure, like convulsion thing. I was, you know, living on the truck. I'm able to open the door, and I'm rolling around on the ground like a fish out of water, going crazy. And in that time, the only thought that comes to really mind that I can remember was, oh my God, the people in AA were right. They're like, right, these people that I hated for so long that I didn't want to be like they were right. And so bizarrely, after getting up from that experience, I got that same service teacher to get me into the extension out in Marietta, and I stayed there for a little bit, and they decided this guy is definitely not serious and he's not going to stay sober, and so they asked me to leave, and I got help getting into Hope Homes, and man, I hit the ground running. You know, when my sponsor said jump, I didn't say how high. I started jumping my butt off. You're like, we'll change that later, man. You just get to moving. And you know, I was those people who got here, and I really did. I was not cool with the God thing. I guess I had been raised in an area. You know, I had such a problem with the word God. You know, like I didn't have a problem with the idea of this greater good, this energy looking out for me in my life. You know, like loving and lifting me up, like having my back. I don't have a problem with that. I had a problem with the word God, right? And the just the closed mindedness that I brought in my heart in the area that I'd been from. And so, going back to what I talked about a minute ago, though, with that internal surrender, I finally hit that willingness, right? Something had been set off within me. I was so willing to work for something different, and I wasn't desperate for, you know, like, oh, maybe I'll do that, maybe I'll do this. I mean, it was just, I was hopeless, right? In the end of the doctor's opinion, he talks about, there's two stories that I want to share with you that whenever I need an uplift, I think about them. And in both those stories, he says two things. He both hits hopeless, no hope in both those stories. And in both those stories, he says they accepted the ideas outlined in this book, right? That's exactly what I did. I was hopeless. And like in hopeless, it's kind of this implied idea of acceptance. And what I had fully accepted is that my butt was whooped by alcohol, right? My butt was whooped by drugs. And so I came to quit, and I came to do the work that we do in recovery. And so the first step, you know, for I know some people do journaling, some people just read the book. All we really did was read the book and go through my experience. You know, I felt, when I met up with that sponsor for the first time, you know, I met so many sponsors before that in my day, and they always ask the same thing, are you willing to go to any lengths? And every time I'd say, you bet I am. And every time I was never willing to go to any lengths. And this last time I met up and he said, hey, are you willing to go to any lengths? And I said, I don't know. Right? I don't know. And that was my first experience with being honest in my life, I feel like. And so, you know, we're going over, you know, what powerlessness means to me, right? What does unmanageability mean to me? What does that look like? And so, step one wasn't hard for me to realize. Like I say, like that was my first bit of like spiritual experience, was like feeling that willingness to want something different. Step two, Ryan talks about on page 46, we just have to have a willingness to believe something greater than ourselves. We don't have to believe in it. And so my sponsor wanted to do the thing where we jot down characteristics of a higher power and what that looks like. So we did all that. Step three, we made a decision, right? I decided that I didn't know what that meant. I really worked from the place of, I don't know what God's will is, right? He's like, all right, we're going to seek and serve God's will every day. I had no idea what that meant, you know? Like, I've been living out of my truck and doing drugs and drinking for the past 10 years of my life and things like this. What does God's will look like? And so, couldn't figure that out on my own, but I could figure out what it didn't look like. You know, it was, hey, don't steal that. You know, like, hey, don't do that to that girl. Hey, don't break the rules at the halfway house. You know, like, hey, don't steal money from work. So started fairly easy things like that. And step four, that was a weird concept to me. I'm going to write my life story. I'm going to write down everyone I resent, all my harms, all my sex conduct. That was very weird. And it was funny. I remember like when he gave me like his packet from the AA website, and he's like, "Go scan off how many copies you need." I scanned like 10 off of resentment, 10 off of harms, 10 off of fears, the fear inventory, and then I like scanned off like 20 of them of the sex conduct. So I was like, "I'm gonna have such a long sex conduct." And I didn't do many of them. I didn't fill them all out. It's just funny how the ego works. And the longest one was by far the fears one. Right, it was by far the fears one, and that was for me specifically. And so, it was funny, you know, like out of all the resentments, I could trace back, you know, the book talks about deep resentment. And, because I didn't actually resent the principal. I didn't actually resent the man at the red light sometimes, or this certain authority figure in my life. Right, I could trace all these back to this deep resentment of my father. Right, and so it was wild to get connected to some of those. And, ultimately, gosh, it was so freeing. You know, I always tell this story, you know, and they talk about the resentment prayer in there in 4 and 5. And, I talk about being at the Kroger. And I love sneakers. I'm a big fan of sneakers. And my dress sneakers that I wear, they're light gray and they have a touch of yellow. And I always wear those with my nicer clothes. I call them my dress Nikes. And I'm a big fan. And so, and I'm being a little spiritual warrior that I am. And I'm at Kroger one day. And I'm getting something to make spaghetti, and I'm leaving, and I've got my bags, and I'm all excited, and I'm walking out the door, and I slam into someone, and I drop it, and the Prego explodes in my dress Nikes. And so I'm loading my mind with four-letter words to let this person know how I feel about them, and by the time I can make eye contact, I realize that this person is blind. And my mind goes from, oh my God, UMF, to oh my God, are you okay? Right, and all of a sudden now I care about the shoes of the individual who can't even see their own shoes, rather than my own. And to feel that way about the other people that I resent, you talk about freeing, to think that maybe this person was even hurting more than I had been, that's maybe how they behave that way, man, to get to set some of that stuff down was, it was crazy. By the way, I didn't start dunking a basketball until AA, and so like maybe I was dropping all those rocks that they talk about. So I don't know, that's something to look at. So launching into 6 and 7, it was funny because I had experiences with AA before. And I would wake up, I was sober in AA, and I would wake up and I would go to work, and I would steal sometimes literally like $1,000 a day sometimes at work. And I'd wake up and I'd pray and be like, God, help me be an honest man today, help me live with integrity, help me live with courage. And I'd wake up, and like I did the books in the back, right, for this restaurant, and I would change the numbers, like I was the one who read it all. And did the reports on it, and so I would change it up, and so I'd steal, you know, $1,000. Then I would still stay clocked in on my lunch hour, you know, just pathetic, like wanted every little bit, so greedy. And I would go to these places with neon signs that you probably shouldn't be at in the middle of the day when you have and you're in a committed relationship. And I would do these things, and I would go back at the end of every day, and I would be like, well, God didn't rip these defects from me. How bizarre. I would just do that over and over again. And so getting to 6 and 7 this last time, I realized there was more than just a prayer that a half-hearted prayer that I was going to throw up. There were two parts to my prayers. There was a prayer that I said, and then there was taking the awareness to look for the action in that day where I could practice the opposing asset. Because the opposite of selfishness was selflessness. right? And so, you know, I wasn't just going to, like, wake up one day and be struck selfless. And so I had to look for, like, just little opportunities. It started with, like, I'm going to do this guy's dishes. Or I'm not going to run the yellow light, and I'm going to let this person go. The littlest things like that, right? And so, you know, it really made sense. Self, you know, the idea they talk about on page, I think, is 62, selfishness, self-centeredness, that would leave is the root of our troubles, right? And so what I came to realize, if that was the root of my troubles, and in the same thread of thought, then selflessness is going to be the root of my solution. And how much sense that actually makes, right? So this whole program, Bellsong, right, this altruistic movement they keep talking about in the doctor's opinion, these steps, these practices, these things that we do, all counterintuitive to what Martin finds cool, fun, or exciting, or hip, right? But what they all do is they take chunks of self out of the situation, and they let me get connected to that greater good that's always been within. I just never taken the time to get connected to that. And it talks about that in the book. You know, down fundamentally down, every man, woman, child loves the idea of God. And, you know, I just had to get still enough and quiet enough and get enough self out of the way to get connected to that. And it's always been there, and I had no idea. And that's been the most amazing thing to get to experience. And so amends are by far the hardest and the most right in proportion to how bad I didn't want to do them was the same amount of liberation that came from doing them. I mean, how do you amend some of the things that we've done? I remember going to my mother and saying, "Hey, Mom, I got to make amends. Here's, you know, giving a little spiel." She just starts crying. Which, you know, I'm not great with crying women. Clearly, I'm not the best with that. And she just starts crying. And I'm like, "Well, what's wrong, Mom?" She's like, "What a stupid step in Alcoholics Anonymous. What a stupid thing to think that you can amend the things you've done in your life." I'm like, "Oh, what do you mean?" And it's like, when you rehash these things, you know, like, there was a time when there was a certain surgery that happened or something, a procedure in the hospital, and all the families meeting at the hospital, and I got there and all drugged out of my mind, right? And I remember Mom just was letting me have it in the parking lot. And I laid hands on my mother that day. And, you know, it wasn't because I would ever want to hurt my mother. It was because she did nothing but tell me the absolute truth of myself in that moment. And the truth of myself I couldn't stand hearing. So I was like, how do you amend that? This being that you have birthed from your own body and that you've spent, you know, all these years with caring and wanting nothing but love and just kindness for, you know, like, and they would do something like that to you. How do you make amends to that? You know, and like some of these girls who said, well, the amends you can make to me would be to never contact me again. I don't even want to hear your name. You've hurt me so bad. And, you know, like, that's a hard bit to get over. Because I can't buy you a psychiatrist and give you 10 years of therapy because I feel like that's what I needed to do for some people. Belmont's been a funny one. I literally sent them an email this past week and was like, hey, I stole this bench, this ashtray, all this furniture from the campus, blah, blah, blah. And at the end of it, it was like 100 chicken sandwiches. And so, not to mention about like 78 spoons from the... Some of you will get that. And so, you know, it's so wild and funny, some of these amends. And so liberating. I remember I once did one of the coolest experiences that I'd been, and it was like literally a spiritual experience when I realized this. I was, there was a family that my dad was dating, this lady and two kids, and I went down there, and my men's trip was going to be with them. And they went bowling. And so I went bowling with them, just trying to participate in the jovialness of the whole thing. And, the kids were kind of depressed, and, you know, they were kind of bickering. My father and this lady was, she's not my stepmother. And I went in the bathroom, and this is just, you know, counterintuitive. Obviously, I've been trained well by you guys at this point. And I go in the bathroom, and I get on my knees, and I pray, just like I did before this meeting. You've trained me so well. And I get on my knees in this dirty bathroom, and I'm praying for these kids, and I'm praying for peace in their life, and I'm praying for kindness and love, for how, you know, for God to be the glue between this relationship between my dad and this lady. And in that moment, I had this flashback that I had been in the same bathroom in North Georgia years before shooting dope, right? And here I am in the same stall, and I'm praying for other people. And you talk about a weird experience and a full 180 in life. Like, that was it. Like, I'd realized I'd really changed. And so that's been a cool thing to be part of. 11, 10, 11, and 12. 10 is where I check with where I'm at with my 3, essentially, right? I'm continuing to take personal inventory. Why am I continuing to do that? I'm continuing to remove bits of self that get in the way, that block me from this Creator that I've now gotten in this very conscious contact with. And so, you know, these things I do on a daily basis, these morning routines, these taking inventories at night, God, where I'm resentful, selfish, dishonest, or self-seeking, I think is the other one. yeah, like this is what I go through every night. And 11, I've had no more growth in anywhere in my spiritual game than with meditation. You know, I would never want to meditate. I'm a closed-minded redneck from the North Georgia mountains. Never would I think that, like, I'm going to, you know, like, love meditation. That man that I was telling you about, that little spiritual teacher of mine, and he talked me into coming and meditating with him one day, and I was like 10 days sober. And I honestly, at that point, like, I was already starting to think that maybe I had a move or two left. And I literally started shooting lime juice to try to trick some, maybe one or two people in here would get that. Trying to trick my body to stop withdrawing. And so, not using drugs, but definitely not sober behavior there. And I wanted to meditate with them. And they talk about these white light spiritual experiences that I always laugh at people for talking about. Man, I had one. I mean, you talk about a mind-blowing experience. I had something occur to me in that moment. You know, and to stand up here and try to put it into words is really a joke in and of itself, right? And if you've had one, you're nodding your head and you know what I'm talking about. But there was a bit of connectedness in that moment that I'd never felt. And it gives me cold chills thinking about it. And I got up from that cushion that day, and I literally didn't even talk to him. I called him the next day to process it because it was so bizarre. I got up and I just left. And from that day till this one, I've worked my butt off to try to like just live and get to like have some of the liberation that other people in here, I saw they had. Right, and I had no idea how you got there, and it was genuinely just a lot of work. You work. And I did that, you know, and I originally, you know, I had those healthy fears, so I'm going to get my butt whooped by drugs and alcohol, right? I originally came in here with this huge flame under my butt. But, you know, and I'm running from that. I'm running from addiction. And what happened is I took some of that flame from my butt, and I put that into my heart, right? And I got this fire in my heart now, and I stopped running from something, and I started running towards something is what we're taught in here. Right? And so why I got up and I did the morning routine again today, or, you know, why I go pick up Swansea, which is out of my way. I love you, Will. You know, I couldn't meet you any day. You know, it's like all these things that I still go and do. It's not because, like, in my mind, it's like, oh, I'm going to get eaten alive by alcohol again. You know, it's just like, no, it's just, I love what I got. I love what I got. And I want to hold on to that. And obviously, I know in the back, you know, like, I know that if I don't continue to do this, like, I'll lose it. I know that. But that's transcended by, like, the joy that I get to live, like, through, like, practicing the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And so, which brings me to why I work so hard at doing the 12th step. Because if I could help one dude, like, my sponsor helped me, I mean, man, I could just sit up here and get teary-eyed about it. If I could help one person change their life, like mine got changed, my entire life would be worth it. You know, I guess it's truly baffling, you know. My definition of cool is like all that ever changed, right? I opened the story talking about how bad I wanted to be cool. Well, what happened is I came in here and I said, I think that guy's kind of cool, right? And what that guy was doing was respecting his family, right? What he was doing was he was paying his bills and he was loving others. What that guy was doing was just living the will of a greater good that he had come to believe in. And all that looked like is he was just going to live the ideals of kindness. He was going to smile and just like be a good guy. And like, that's all I ever really wanted to do when I was a little boy. Right? And so it was all genuinely learned behaviors that you taught me. I never popped out of the womb a drug and alcoholic and thought to myself, I'm going to slap this nurse on the ass, take a shot of hard liquor, and go for a wild ride. You know, like I wasn't born that way. Like I learned to be that way. And I learned to unbe that way through my mentors of Alcoholics Anonymous. Right? I came in here and I sat down and I shut up. And I set up the chairs and I set down the chairs. And, you know, I made the men's when I was told to make the men's. You know, I just put a little bit of ego out of the way for the first time in my life, and the rewards can't be quantified in anything at all. But you know, if you're in here, you're working towards it, and if you got any bit of that liberation, I'm so excited for you. Thank you so much. Thank you, Will and Zach, for coming out. You are my heroes. Thank you.
Thank you, Martin. That was great. And I have asked Tinsley to come up and pass out the chips.
My name is Tinsley. I'm an alcoholic. Thank you so much for sharing your story. I really enjoyed that. Here at this meeting, we have a chip system to mark our time away from our last drink. If you'd like to try this way of life one day at a time, we offer a white chip. Anybody like to pick up a white chip? After 30 days, we have a silver chip. Anybody got 30 days? Red chip for 90 days? How about a yellow chip for 6 months? A green chip for 9 months? Any birthdays? Anybody want to reconsider on a white chip? Yeah. Again, for the chips you hold.
It'll never leave if I give it and just go.